All right, well, good. Okay, so this is bio 231, and it's August 27th, and it is 2014. Okay, so I did it in the wrong year. And I think we have a question. Who had a question? Hi. Blackboard quizzes, yeah? Yeah, I'm supposed to have it programmed to where you can see your answers for every question, and then you'll know if it's wrong or not, because it will say zero for so many points. Okay. And if I misprogrammed it, I'll have to double check and reprogram it. Oh, it doesn't show you which one you get wrong? Okay. Yeah, there's something that happened to Blackboard. It didn't transfer over. Okay, I'll make sure you do that, because otherwise, yeah, you don't really know where to go. Okay, yeah. It doesn't tell you what the right answer is, but it should tell you that you got that question wrong. Okay, yeah, I'll check on that. And you might even want to send me an email in case I forget. Okay, yeah, hi.
So for the online quizzes, if you take it multiple times, so you can score that is recorded is the highest one?
In your grade book, it should be the highest one.
Is that only for the extra credit, or is that even
for all the online quizzes? So you can take an unlimited number of times. Say you take it the first time and you just want to get a sense of what's going on and you completely guess and you get 100%, and then you figure, well, I should probably really understand what's going on. I better go back and see what the answers are and make sure I get it right. And then the second time you really pay attention and you only get 50%, the 100% goes into your grade book.
Okay.
It's still a log that you've taken it and what your score was. But at least I programmed it that way. Unless there's an error in there. We'll catch it if there's an error. Then you go in the third time and get better score fourth time. And so you can take it still many times after you get 100% just to practice taking them until the deadline. After the deadline, then no more. Okay. All right, so when is the deadline in here?
Thursday.
What time? 11 p.m., that's right. All right, so just ingrain that in your memory. Any other questions regarding the class? Oh, some students still want to add the class. So the way you add the class is by finding a spot in lab. And there's one lab that's left. That's at 12:55. So show up to the very start of that lab. I take roll call, and somebody that's not there that's registered gets dropped right away. So don't be late to lab, because chances are you're going to be dropped. And then I give add codes to replace the no-shows. So that's where we're rate limited the most, is in lab. Okay, because I can still see a few empty seats here, but in lab we're completely full. All right, let's take a look at the right-hand slide, and that's just the syllabus. And the reason why I'm showing you the syllabus is because I want to make sure that you guys are on track and that we're staying on track with lectures. So I want to look at the schedule. So we went over orientation, chapter one, almost the whole thing, so we got to finish that up, but gave you an orientation on Blackboard. And today we're going to get into chapter two, or cells. And maybe we can finish that up, maybe not, I'm not sure. Excuse me. Okay. So has anybody got a question on the syllabus at all?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I will go over, say, pages 1 through 13 on the first lecture, more or less, and then on the second lecture, 21 through 43. So pages that are not included here are not in your reading list.
So should we read it before?
That will help you, because you also have pre-lecture reading assignments, and the answers to those pre-lecture reading assignments is on these pages right here. So if you're a little bit more familiar with what's going to be talked about in class before you come, then the lecture will just be more meaningful to you. And if you don't understand something even after I talk about it, then it's a great time to ask a question, right? Because if you hear something the first time, you might have a sense, well, I don't know if I should ask a question or not. I don't know if I know it or not. I might be able to pick it up pretty fast. But if you look at the material ahead of time and then I talk about it and it's still kind of hazy, then you should probably feel really good to ask me a question. Okay? Yeah, so I would certainly look at the organization of the chapter, maybe read some parts of it, at least enough to answer the pre-lecture reading assignment. Okay. A pre-lecture reading assignment, if you don't do them before class, but you do them before a test, won't help you very much because they're really questions designed to orient you to the information in that chapter. It's not really to teach you a lot of things about that chapter. So if you're learning at the level of a pre-lecture reading assignment, by the time a test comes around, that's really not nearly good enough. Right? So the pre-lecture before the lecture, but then after that, you got to learn a lot more stuff. Layer on top of the pre-lecture assignment. Okay, so I think we got through a lot of things. Body planes, how many planes are there? Yeah, there's three. And so you got to know their names. What's this one? Transverse. And this one? And this one?
Frontal.
Ah, what's this one again? And this one? Frontal. Yeah, good. There's probably some interactive exercises in Blackboard. You have a nice exam figure. If you look at the study guide that covers the plane, so definitely you got to know your planes, how to talk about it. But that exam figure, I could copy that and put it on the test as well. Make sure you can label that exam figure as far as the planes are concerned. Only a couple other things. You got oblique, which is what? Angulated. You've got mid-sagittal, right smack in the middle. I didn't go over this last time. Parasagittal means it's a sagittal, but not right on midline. It's shifted to the right or to the left. Right, but sagittal certainly separates your body into what parts? Sagittal separates you into right and left. That's a nice way to think of it. Okay. All right, so let's look at some body regions. Well, we've got head and neck. All right, we've got the trunk, which contains the thorax, abdomen, and pelvis. And then we have our limbs. And this is really what I want to get to here. Limbs, you got arms, you got legs, you got thighs and forearms. And this is where the terminology is a lot different than what we use in everyday normal life because I'm going to point to this part of an appendage. What is this that I'm pointing to right now?
Forearm.
Okay. Some of you guys have been doing some studies. That's great. This is not your arm, believe it or not. This is your forearm, right? Between your elbow and your wrist is your forearm. But you do have an arm. Where is your arm? Between your elbow and your shoulder. Right? So your arm is what? Proximal or distal to your forearm?
Proximal.
The arm is proximal compared to the forearm. Right? It's closer to some center location or attachment point to your body. So we did talk about directional terms last time as well. You don't use these in everyday language, so you have to study them. You got to kind of develop your language a little bit with them. So there's a lot of questions online, got a lot of questions in lecture for proximal, distal, superficial, deep. All right, here's another one. Where is your leg? Am I pointing to my leg? No, what am I pointing to? My thigh, that's right, you might think it's your leg. It's your lower appendage for sure, but that part of it is your thigh. Hip to knee is thigh, knee to ankle is your leg, right, is your leg. All right, so make sure you understand these things right here. Some exam figures, let me put that away. Let's look at some figures. There are the body planes, okay. Have some interactive exercises on these body regions. This is an exam figure, and so what kind of view is this? Is this a lateral view, or posterior view, or anterior view? Anterior view. Yeah, we're looking at the front. And then this would be the posterior view. Is this person in anatomic position? Yes. Why do you know that? Because the thumbs are lateral, I wouldn't say out, or you could say that the palms are facing forward if we go back to this anterior view. Either one of those would be a nice definition. Okay, so this looks a little complicated, but it's really handy for you to know what these body regions are because we're going to use these regions, at least most of them, through the rest of the class. So if you know a region, you also know, for instance, the name of an artery or a nerve that goes through that region and names of muscles. All right, so let's maybe just go over a couple of these. All right, brachial region right here, that means the arm. So you could tell me the name of that artery that goes through this part of your body. That is the brachial artery. You know the name of the nerve. That's the brachial nerve. So it's not a waste of time. It might seem a little tedious, but go ahead and get these down really good because that will just have you shoot through the rest of the class in some way. Okay, same thing for femoral, right? That's the anterior thigh. Let me look at some regions in the head. Orbital, okay, refers to the eye. Right, we got orbital right here because that socket that your eyeball fits in, that's called an orbit. And we're going to learn some muscles and some nerves associated with that. Oral, right, is around your mouth. What's not on this slide, which is too bad, maybe it's on the posterior, let me look. I'd like to see a lead line going right to this thing. What am I, can you see what I'm pointing to? Yeah, the ear, good. I didn't know if it was too small for you to see. Now, it is. I see it right here. All right, your ear is the otic region, otic. So otic and optical or ocular are two different things. Optic refers to your eyes, optic or orbital, your eyes, otic to your ear. That's, I think, important to know because there are different instruments that a physician or you guys will use to investigate an eyeball or an ear, and they have different names, right? So something that you use to look into somebody's eyes, an ophthalmoscope, but you don't use an ophthalmoscope to look into somebody's ear, you use an otoscope, and that's how these things get their names, right? So a lot of things do tie together very nice. All right, behind the knee is popliteal, underneath the arms, let's go to the other slide right here. It's axillary. Do we have, oh yeah, axillary right here. Okay, brachial. Cephalic means toward the head. Oh, mental. The tip of your chin right here is the mental region. I don't know why they call it the mental region. I kind of have to think about why it's the mental region. But you could probably tell me the name of the muscle that's right there. That's the mental muscle, but we call it the mentalis. So again, when you learn this list, you'll learn a lot of things about muscles and nerves and arteries and a whole bunch of other stuff. Okay, drag and drop exercises in Blackboard might be the best way to get this figure down. Just practice it a couple times. All right, the other thing, the last thing in this chapter are body cavities. And here's a list of body cavities, but let's take a look at a picture. This is an extra credit picture that you can draw. I can't find it quick, so I guess I got to go over here and look for it. That you will draw in lab. Ah, nice. Okay, here are some body cavities. So you can think of your body as things that are in cavities and things that are not in cavities. So you could think of cavity versus not cavity is your body. So things that are in cavities we call visceral organs. Right, so that's your viscera. The rest of your body that's not in a cavity, we call that the somatic region. And so you'll have you'll have bones and you'll have skeletal muscle in the somatic regions, but in cavities you're going to have visceral organs. And can anybody maybe tell me an example of a visceral organ that you would find in one of these cavities deep inside your body? Would be? Heart. I like heart. Heart, lung, stomach. Right, reproductive organs are not going to be around skeletal muscle or the skeleton. It's going to be protected in these body cavities, and indeed, it's part of the job of your skeleton to create these cavities and then act as armor plating for them so that whatever in there doesn't get damaged, right? All right, so what are these cavities? Sometimes it's really simple. Sometimes there's cavities in the back, and we're just going to call that dorsal because dorsal and posterior are the same, right? Back, posterior, the same. So here is the dorsal cavity. And then in this little bit darker color, these are the cavities that are anterior, but another name for anterior is ventral. So all of these things here are in the ventral cavity. The other thing that you probably see right away is that a cavity can have subcavities with inside of it. So here is the ventral cavity. But how many cavities make up the ventral cavity on this illustration right here? I see three. I see pelvic cavity, abdominal cavity, and thoracic cavity. But just like we can have cavities inside cavities if it's the ventral cavity, even the thoracic cavity can have subcavities. There can be cavities inside cavities. And it's important to know what these things are. The cavity that just your lungs are in are called the pleural cavities. So here would be the right pleural cavity. Here's the left. Does your textbook go into that much detail? I usually am not so concerned about right or left. It's not annotated on the slide. Okay, but this would be a nice anterior view. So this would be left. This would be right over here. So the cavity within the thoracic cavity that has only the lungs are the pleural cavities. You have some cavities in the center. The cavity that holds the heart, contains the heart, that's called the pericardial cavity, just by itself, pericardial cavity. The membrane around that cavity is called the pericardium. That tells you about another word. When you hear that word peri, that means around or surrounding. Pericardium, right, is the material that surrounds the heart. All right, the heart, the pericardial cavity, is a part of another cavity. It's not part of the pleural cavity. Right? It's part of the thoracic cavity, but it's a part of another cavity as well. And it's this one right here. Okay? And go ahead and say this name once. Yes, it's got a little swing to it. I think most people mispronounce it, so I'm going to say it. It's called mediastinum. Mediastinum. Go ahead and say it like that. Mediastinum. Yeah. You might hear mediastinum and all kinds of really cool things, but mediastinum is the way we say that. So the mediastinum is a cavity that separates the right and left pleural cavities. And does it contain any important organs? Does the mediastinum contain any important organs? Like your heart. Some of you might think that's your most favorite organ. It's probably not, because probably your brain is. All right, so it has really important organs. It also contains the great blood vessels that come off the heart, like the aorta and the pulmonary artery and vena cava and things like that. Truly important blood vessels. All right, so the mediastinum holds a number of important things, and especially for the neonate. Oh, what's a neonate? Are you guys neonates? Not for a long time. A neonate is a newborn, right? And sometimes during gestation, during development, these arteries don't get attached to the heart in the right position. And maybe the heart doesn't develop correctly, or maybe there's even holes within the chambers of the heart, right? And somebody then is born and they have a special color associated with that condition. Does anybody know something about it? The color of a person when they're born, when the blood isn't flowing through their lungs properly? It's called cyanosis, which means blue. Cyanosis means blue. They're cyanotic, which means that their blood isn't red. Red blood is oxygenated. They basically have venous blood going everywhere in their body, which is not oxygenated, and that doesn't help them very much. That means they're starving for oxygen. So, and that goes into a score. Does anybody know what that score is? As soon as you're born, they give you a number. Apgar score. Yeah, what is that? I think 1 to 5. And they measure different things, reflexes, and color is one of them, right? And if someone is cyanotic, somebody's going to yell out, we need a scan of the mediastinum right away, stat. And so you got to know what mediastinum is, because then you know it has something to do with the heart and those blood vessels that might not be connected up the right way, right? So mediastinum is a good one to know. All right, so what cavities, what are all the cavities that you can find that make up the ventral cavity? And you can use this nice anterior view to see that. Well, let's start at one end. We've got pelvic cavity, got abdominal cavity, we've got the mediastinum, we've got the pericardial cavity, and we've got the pleural cavities. And some of these are inside other cavities. Sometimes there's a nice separation between these cavities. Like, if we look at the ventral cavity, we see the thoracic cavity right here, and then the abdominal cavity underneath it, all parts of the ventral cavity. And they are nicely and distinctly separated from each other by this structure right here. Right? So it's, yeah, so it's difficult to go from thoracic to abdominal cavity because that structure is there separating them. And somebody told me what it is, and you should know what it is too. It's the diaphragm. The diaphragm is a skeletal muscle that allows you to inhale when it contracts. So that's a really important muscle. We'll learn a lot about that muscle and how it's innervated later. Right, so there's a nice separation, but there's no nice separation between the abdominal cavity and the pelvic cavity. There's nothing that really separates them. It's a construct that we have in our mind, and it has to do with where the pelvic bones are located. That's how we define it when we get into the skeletal system for a pelvic bone. We'll learn more about where this pelvic cavity is. All right, so things can move from the abdominal cavity into the pelvic cavity very freely because there's nothing that separates them. So a lot of times, we want to think of the abdominal cavity and the pelvic cavity as really just being one cavity, because it really is just one. There's nothing that separates them. So when we want to talk about both of these together, we can use a particular nomenclature that describes that. We can use the name of the abdominal cavity and combine it with pelvic cavity, and as long as you combine them in just the right way, everybody will know what you're talking about. In anatomy, we can take two different structures, put them together, if we're talking about both at the same time, as long as we put an O between those words. So this not only is the abdominal and pelvic cavity, it is what? The abdominopelvic. Not abdominal pelvic cavity, but abdominopelvic cavity is both of these things together. Okay, so do you see that little O right there? Another name sometimes, because it's a really important cavity, not only do we call it the abdominal pelvic cavity, we call it the peritoneal cavity. Peritoneum or peritoneal cavity is the same thing as abdominal pelvic. It might be on this slide. I can't find it immediately. Does anybody see it on this slide? Peritoneal cavity. I'm sure it's in your book. All right, so that's the ventral cavity. As opposed to the dorsal cavity, how many cavities make up the dorsal cavity? I got two, right? And these are special because bones form these cavities, and these bones are really armor plating for tissue that's very delicate, even more delicate than your heart, probably even more delicate than your lungs. Your lungs are terribly delicate, but this tissue is even more delicate, and it is your nervous system, right? So here is your brain inside the cranial cavity, and then here is your spinal cord, okay, inside the vertebral cavity. So vertebral cavity and spinal cord are really two different things. Spinal cord is nervous tissue inside the vertebral cavity. All right, so that's a pretty good job of talking about all of these cavities. And again, there's no separation between the cranial cavity and the vertebral cavity, but there's a really nice line of demarcation. Some of you might have heard of foramen magnum, and the foramen magnum is the separation between the brain and the spinal cord right here. A foramen is a hole in a bone, and what do you think magnum means? Magnum. It's like grande. It means big. This is the biggest hole in your head right here, foramen magnum, so that the spinal cord can leave the brain. That's a nice separation between the brain and the spinal cord. Brain and spinal cord are all central nervous system. We'll learn about that. All right, so that's it for this chapter, I think. Let me look at what's here. Yeah, we could maybe just play with this a little bit. What cavity do we see right here? Pleural cavity. What cavity do we see right here? The pericardial cavity, and if you wanted to say something about mediastinum, that would be okay with me, right? Because here's the mediastinum. Mediastinum has the heart, also has the thymus gland, that's an endocrine gland, and great blood vessels that are deep to the thymus gland, which we can't see. What does it mean when I say deep? These blood vessels are deep. Not superficial, which means that if we take this thymus gland away, take it away, we would see the deeper vessels underneath it, right? Okay, so what about the thymus gland? How would you describe the thymus gland with respect to these great blood vessels coming off the heart? The thymus gland is? Okay, it is anterior. This is true. But there's another way that I was thinking about it. You're exactly right. It's anterior. It is superficial, right? It is superficial. It's more toward the surface, right? All right. The membranes that surround these cavities, all right? So we're looking at the pleural membrane. Pleural means lung. And sometimes you get an inflammation or an infection of this membrane, or maybe there's a cavity in here as well, and that is called pleurisy, right? So pleural cavity and pleurisy line up. Has anybody ever had pleurisy in here, an infection of this lining on the lungs? You're really miserable when that happens. Whenever you take a breath because of this inflammation, it feels like somebody has a knife and is stabbing you in the chest. Okay? Which what? You don't ever want to volunteer for that. That's a terrible feeling. Okay? But, so you don't want to breathe. But what's it like if you don't breathe? How do you feel? We could do an experiment, but let's not. Because we'd all have to pass out and then wake up to know what it feels like. Right? It's terrible. So here you have a patient, and if they breathe, they feel like somebody's stabbing them. If they don't breathe, they feel like they're dying. And there's no other choice. What do you do for a patient that no matter what they do, they have this terrible pain in their body? In that circumstance, opiates are fine, right? Get somebody breathing again, right? But of course, you want to attack the cause of this thing, antibiotics. Maybe you even have to I've never heard of this, right? Maybe you even have to aspirate some of that fluid out. Oh, after surgery, maybe that happens sometimes. Maybe if somebody's having surgery in this region, fluid fills up in the pleural cavity and people have a hard time breathing. The best way to help them right away is just to jab a needle in there and suck that fluid out, and they can start breathing immediately. And they'll even thank you even after jabbing them in the chest with a needle. Okay. Same thing for the pericardial cavity. Sometimes it gets infected. That's called pericarditis. That is very serious, right? Because your heart is a very important organ. And when that cavity fills up with fluid, the heart can't pump blood. Can you think about why the heart can't pump blood when the pericardial cavity starts to fill up with fluid? Yeah, there's no space for blood to get into the pericardial cavity, and if blood can't get in, maybe the heart is contracting, but it's not doing what? It's not pumping blood because blood isn't getting into that cavity. Right? So that infection is very serious, and that routinely is treated with somebody jabbing a needle very close to your heart and sucking that fluid out. Okay. All right, so that's some importance with all of these different cavities. Who's got a question on chapter 1? Yes. Yeah, this is a good time to talk about that. Okay. So there are different layers that cover things inside of our body. And we would like to call those membranes. And so there are membranes that cover parts of your body that are open to the outside world, like your oral cavity. We look at some of those cells in lab if you've had lab already. That's what we call a mucous membrane. And a mucous membrane only has one part to it. So what are some mucous membranes? Nasal cavity has a mucous membrane, oral cavity, digestive tract has a mucous membrane because your inside of your digestive tract really is on the outside world. It's not inside your body, it's just a tube. It's a tunnel running through your body. Reproductive system is open to the outside world. That has a mucous membrane. As opposed to a cavity that's not open to the outside world. This pericardial cavity is not open to the outside world. Right? The outside of the lung here, the surface of the lung is not open to the outside world. The inside is, right? Oh, here, your respiratory tract is an example of a mucous membrane because it's open to the outside world. But this region right here is not open to the outside world. It's got a membrane called a serous membrane, not a mucous membrane. You guys do have to know this, I think, for the first test, so it's okay that I go over it right now. It's a serous membrane, and a serous membrane has three parts to it, a little bit more complicated compared to a mucous membrane. Let's see if I can find the three parts. I might have to just zoom in just a little bit right here. Yes, I can see. Oh, even better yet. All right, so did you lose track? What organ is this right here? That's the lung, right? So we're in the pleural cavity. And here is the surface of the lung. And you see this little bit, looks darker line right here? You can tell me what color it is. It kind of looks orange. Orange, close to orange, okay. Well, that is a membrane right on the surface of the lungs. And remember, we said these organs inside a body cavity are considered viscera. This is a visceral compartment. So this is what we call the visceral serous membrane. It's right on the surface of the lung. All right, so that's the first part. If we follow that visceral membrane someplace, it's not shown on this slide, okay? Well, that's the first division. All right, there is another part of the serous membrane that lines the body wall, the cavity, the lining of the cavity. This is what we call the parietal serous membrane. And that's the parietal pleural membrane. This membrane right here that's on the surface of the lungs is the visceral pleural membrane. But you might also notice that there's a space between them that's filled with fluid. And that just allows these organs to slip and slide around a little bit with respect to each other. And since that is a serous membrane, we call that serous fluid inside that serous membrane. So the deepest one lying on the organ is the visceral part of the serous membrane. You got the serous space filled with serous fluid, and then the parietal division is lining the cavity, not the organ itself. Yeah. So there is a serous membrane around the lungs, there's a serous membrane around the heart, okay, and around all of the organs in your abdominal and pelvic cavity as well. And I'm going to go over those specifically, not in this chapter, but in a chapter coming up. If I got some really good figures, maybe I will talk about it a little bit more. Okay, so how is it, what's a good model to have in your mind to understand a serous membrane? Remember, serous membrane's got three parts, a mucous membrane only one. And you find them in different parts of your body. How does your body make a serous membrane? Well, let's take a balloon, just a balloon and not do anything to it. We take a balloon and then we push our finger or maybe our whole hand inside the balloon. Now, is your hand inside the balloon? Not really. It's, you sort of have a conception it's inside, but it's really outside. Why is it outside? Well, there are two membranes. There is the part of the balloon that's touching the hand. That would be the visceral division of a serous membrane. And then it's continuous with this other part that folds much more superficially. So this is the parietal division. And of course, we didn't burst the balloon, so there is air still inside the balloon. That would be the serous cavity filled with serous fluid if this were a real body compartment. All right, so those are the three divisions, once again, of a serous membrane. Visceral, cavity, and parietal divisions. Okay, here is the I don't see any lungs, but I see digestive organs, and there is a membrane. So this is a visceral cavity. What can I do? Let's go over here. All right, so here is the wall of your body, the muscle wall of your body, abdominal muscles. And I see a membrane here, I see a space, and then another membrane right on the surface of the liver, right? So this would be the visceral peritoneum. Here is the parietal peritoneum. Peritoneum means abdominal pelvic cavity. And then here is that serous cavity between the visceral and parietal divisions of the membrane that surrounds the abdominal pelvic cavity, which we call the peritoneal cavity sometimes. Okay. So remember, this cavity is not open to the outside world, so it has a serous membrane associated with it. Same thing for the heart. Okay, here's a nice heart. So the heart, if we think of the smallest cavity that the heart is in, what would that be? Would it be abdominal cavity? No. Okay, the smallest one. Would it be pleural cavity? No. It would be the pericardial cavity. All right, so these are the pericardial membranes surrounding the heart. The one right on the surface of the heart that I'm tracing out right here, this is what, the visceral or the parietal? Visceral, because it's right on that visceral organ. Here is the parietal division, and in between the two you have serous fluid. Sometimes we call that pericardial fluid. Say pericardial fluid. And it should only have a certain amount, not very much. Okay, and if this thing, if the pericardial space right here fills up with fluid that compresses the heart and then blood doesn't get in, and even if the heart is pumping, it can't pump any blood because no blood's getting into it. And that's very bad for a patient, right? They could die very easily when that happens. Okay, that's good for chapter one. Any other good questions? Any other good questions? Okay. Know your directional terms. So in anatomy, don't forget, repetition is key. Look over these figures, do drag and drop. If you have to draw them out for you to get an impression of what's going on there to help your memory, go ahead and draw them out on a blank piece of paper. And in lab, at least one lab, I said another important thing. What's another important or useful technique for some people? Because it activates so much of your brain. Talk anatomy to somebody. Okay, if you know somebody with a heart condition, sit them down, maybe it's your grandma even, and say, oh, here's the heart and look at these membranes. You got three membranes. You got the visceral membrane and you got this fluid space right here. Here's the parietal division, right, that is superficial compared to the visceral organ. And when you talk to somebody, even if they don't understand what you're talking about, it helps you learn. Right? So talk to each other, talk to family members. If you have a son that's 4 years old, go ahead, make him sit down. Teach them something about anatomy. And you know what? By the time they get to school, they'll learn. Most kids know a lot of anatomy already. It's amazing what we know before we even go to school. All right, so that's chapter one. Chapter two. Here's some lecture notes on chapter 2. I have it labeled cytology. Maybe somewhere else we say histology. What's the difference between cytology and histology? Cytology is the study of cells, individual cells, and what their shape is, right? And if you know what their shape is, you have an idea of what their function is, right? Okay. Histology is not the study of a single cell, but it's a group of cells. Histology really is the study of a tissue. All right, so a group of cells is a tissue. What's a building block of a tissue? That's what we learned last time. The hierarchical organization of things. What do you need to make a tissue? Okay. I like cells. What's the building block of a cell? Now you got organelles. Yeah, what's the building block of an organelle? Molecules. Molecules. So you got to have a bunch of molecules to make an organelle. Got to have a bunch of organelles to make a cell. Bunch of cells to make a tissue, and you take a bunch of tissues that will make an organ, and if we put a bunch of organs together, do we get you? Not quite. We get an organ system, but if we put all the organ systems together, then we get you. Then we get the organism. Okay. So make sure you can run up and down that level of organization. All right, so we're interested in the cell, and that's hugely important because what can you tell me about the cell? You need it to make tissues. This is true. But there's something else. There's something else. Okay. That's the building block for life. Yeah, it's the structural and functional unit of life. Is this what I want? Yes, this is what I want. Okay. All right. So, here is a cell. The basic building block of life. If there is something that's not made of cells, it cannot be alive. Right, so what makes a cell? There's three important things that make up a cell. There's got to be a cell membrane that separates the inside from the outside world. And I see the cell membrane right here. We're going to learn something about that cell membrane. It's special, super special. Right, and it's got to have genetic material. Here's DNA inside the nucleus. Here's a membrane around the nucleus, so this DNA is protected from what's ever happening inside the cell. The DNA contains information on how to build your cell. Right, so here is the blueprint for building this particular cell. And hopefully it is a blue color. Is it blue? Blueprint, right? So that determines the shape of all of these structures right here. Right, so the blueprint determines the structure of this cell. But if it determines the structure, what else is it determining? The function. Yeah, the function of all these different things that have different shapes inside the cell. So that genetic material determines the structure and the function of the cell because it determines the structure. All right, so that's the first two things, cell membrane and genetic material. In order for it to be a cell, it's got to have another thing, and that is cytoplasm. So all of this thing between the cell membrane and the nuclear membrane, this is cytoplasm. And if it has those three things, then chances are it's alive. And if it's alive, what can you do to it? You can kill it. Right? And if it's not a cell, it's not alive, you can't kill it, like a virus. Maybe I mentioned that last time. All right, so cytoplasm has two components to it. I think I want to put this over here. Two components of cytoplasm. It has organelles, these more solid structures that I see. Here's a mitochondria. And it also has just pure fluid, which with a bunch of chemicals dissolved in it. That's what we call cytosol. Cytosol is one component of cytoplasm, and organelle is the other component. All right, so cytoplasm has two parts, organelle and cytosol. I think your book makes a distinction of that. Maybe it's too old to do that, but that's the modern-day way to think of cytoplasm, organelles plus cytosol. Okay, so cell, basic unit of all living organisms. Cell must contain genetic material, cytoplasm, and a cell membrane. Oh, I don't have that here. Put cell membrane. All life is cellular. The simple organisms are just one cell. And we call those unicellular. And some organisms are made up of trillions of cells. They are multicellular. So are you unicellular or multicellular? Right now you're multicellular. Right? At one point in time you were unicellular, but right now you're not. Within the cell, contain specialized structures called organelles. They have different shapes, so they have what? Different functions. We're going to learn what some of those functions are, right? Most organelles have a membrane around them, like this mitochondria. Here is a membrane that surrounds a mitochondria. Mitochondria is special because even inside there's a second membrane. Okay, it has two membranes, but most organelles have a membrane around them. We call those membrane-bound. A membrane-bound organelle, it just means that it's an organelle with a membrane around them. An example of an organelle that is not membrane-bound is a centriole. And these tubules right here, microtubules, microfilaments, do not have a membrane around them. They're not membrane-bound. That membrane helps determine what moves in and what moves out of that particular organelle. That's why it's there. Okay, what's the first membrane or the first organelle we want to look at? Well, the cell membrane is very special, so that's really an organelle. All right, so let's look at the cell membrane. And when we look at the cell membrane, here is a nice illustration of the cell membrane. Let's look at it in a very simplistic form. So when you look at this, right, so we're zooming into this region here. When we look at this cell membrane, how many layers do you see from top to bottom? Does anything stand out? How many layers? Do you see layers? Do you see any layers at all? I see two. I see one layer here, and then I see another layer right there. So sometimes we call a cell membrane a bilayer. It's a bilayer because it's made up of two different layers in its most rudimentary form. And this little ball right here represents a phosphate group, right? And these long little tails right here are lipids or fats, right? But the phosphate and these lipids are put together to make one compound, so they're called phospholipids. And you can see that this membrane is one phospholipid next to another one, all the way down the line. And then if you flip it around, you got more phospholipids down over here. So the very simplest way to think about a cell membrane is by calling it a phospholipid bilayer. And you see that here, phospholipid bilayer. Hugely important when you get into physiology. And that's a good place to start. But do you see other things besides phospholipids in this membrane? Do you see anything else in there? Ah, I see some proteins. Yeah, I see some integral proteins. I see cholesterol. I see these things poking off the top of it. All right, so depending on the cell, the nucleus will determine what gets associated, put into the membrane or on top of the membrane. So it has a composition of many different things. And so a better way to think of a membrane is not just a simple phospholipid bilayer, because that's not really what it is. A good way to think about it is by using the fluid mosaic model, because the phospholipid part of the membrane is very fluid. Right? It undulates around. It's not very strong. Mosaic means what? A lot of other kinds of pieces are added to it. So what can be added to it? I see cholesterol inserted into the membrane. Cholesterol gives some rigidity and strength to the membrane so that when you stand up, your membranes just don't drip out on the floor. Right? That's why that cholesterol is in there. That's the part of the mosaic that makes the phospholipid bilayer work. We have some proteins, and here is a passageway across the membrane. This is what we call a channel, and it's called an integral protein because it's tightly associated with the membrane. If we were to take this protein off or out of the membrane, we would destroy it. That's the definition of integral protein. Scientists like to get their hands on these proteins to study them, and if you have to rip the membrane apart to get to it, that's an integral protein. So here's a channel. This one right here might actually be an enzyme that supports some kind of chemical reaction. Right? Here we see an integral protein, and then on top of it is a peripheral protein. We can get to these without disturbing the membrane, and these could have different functions as well. Sometimes it can be a gated channel. Sometimes they open up and sometimes they close, allowing things to move in and out of the cell at some times, but not all times. And the nucleus can help determine that. Here's another peripheral protein. All right, and these things here, these are sugar molecules poking up off the surface of a membrane. And you notice that they have particular shapes to them. These are sometimes what we call antigens. And the way that your body knows that this particular cell belongs to you and is not some other cell from the outside world is by the shape of these antigens. So all the cells in your body have a particular antigen that has a particular shape. So your immune system doesn't kill that cell under normal most circumstances, right? But if you are given an organ from another person, then the shapes of these antigens are different, and your immune system will recognize that. And what will it know that when it sees that these shapes of these antigens are different? What will it know? Your immune system will know what? It doesn't belong in your body, and it will kill those cells. We call that rejection. And of course, your body doesn't know at that molecular level that you paid a couple $1 million for a heart transplant and you really don't want to get rid of that heart, but you got to then take drugs to help control the immune system so that it doesn't reject that living tissue that's put in your body. And it does so by looking at these sugar molecules on the outside. Whenever you see glyco, that means sugar. Okay, and when you see lipid, that means fat. So if you see glycolipid, you know that it's made of two different kinds of compounds. One is a sugar, one is a fat. Here is a glycoprotein. What is a glycoprotein made out of? Sugar and proteins put together. All right. So we'll look at some. That will get you interested in some organelles inside the cell. All right. So the basic description, phospholipid bilayer. And then all of these other pieces give different structure to the membrane, which gives what to the membrane? Different functions. So different cells have different kinds of things inserted into the membrane, so different cells have different functions. And it's a job of the nucleus to determine what to put into the membrane. And some cells are so smart that they will put a certain complement of structures in the membrane over here, and then on the other side of the cell, different kinds of proteins and glycolipids on the other side. So what can you tell me about the membrane on this side compared to this side of the cell? The function is different. So this nucleus right here can even make different sides of the cell operate or function differently because it can put different components in the membrane. So phospholipid bilayer is not a really good way to think of the membrane. You should think of it as the fluid mosaic model, right? Fluid mosaic model. All right, so what are some of those things? Could be membrane channels, carrier molecules, moving things across the membrane, receptor molecules. This could be a good example of a receptor. Sometimes we want to signal the cell to do something special, in which case a hormone will come floating by and bind to this thing right here, and that hormone will then change the physiology inside the cell. This thing is what we call a receptor, right? So a signaling molecule has to bind to a receptor before it can affect the physiology inside the cell. Could be enzymes, mentioned that, antigens, recognition or identifier proteins, structural supports. What did we say was a structural support in this membrane? Okay, in particular cholesterol. But even all these proteins do give structural support to the cell. And exchange pumps. I didn't say much about this. But a pump is something, say you have a water pump, and you have water in a well, and you're on the surface up over here, you're not by that water. What do you need to get that water from low to high? Will it just run up all by itself? You need energy to do that, right? And so a pump is something that can take energy and move something from low to high. Same thing with certain kinds of proteins within the membrane. We call them pumps because they can move things from a pump from low concentration to a high concentration. It takes energy. Does anybody remember what we said was the energy molecule in our bodies, ourselves? Is ATP. ATP. There's other energy, important energy molecules, but the one that's most readily available is ATP. And since we're talking about organelles, probably you should know what organelle makes ATP from us. That is that mitochondria, right? The mitochondria. All right, so let's talk about some other organelles inside the cell. Okay, here's some pictures on pumps and things like that, but let's look at this slide right here. Rough endoplasmic reticulum is a membrane. All right, so it's a system of membranes. Sometimes it looks like tubes. Sometimes it looks like a bunch of plates or pancakes laid up on top of each other. And this membrane over here has these little dots on them all over the place. Kind of looks like sandpaper, which is what? Sandpaper is rough or smooth? It's rough. So here is rough endoplasmic reticulum. And for each one of these organelles, I'd like for you to know at least one important function that it does. So rough ER makes proteins. Protein synthesis is the job for rough endoplasmic reticulum. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum doesn't have these little dots all over the place, so it cannot make a protein. But it can make lipids. And it can actually make a lipid and have a phosphate group joined to it. It can make phospholipids. And is it a good idea to have a lot of phospholipids in these cells? What do you need a phospholipid for? Yeah, to make all the membranes in your body, the cell membrane, all these other membranes around mitochondria. Their basic nature is a phospholipid bilayer. Okay? All right, so here's smooth endoplasmic reticulum. You should say lipid synthesis. Rough ER, protein synthesis. And I want to give you one more function for smooth endoplasmic reticulum. If you were to ask anybody, the first thing they would say would be lipid synthesis, but there's another important thing. It can store calcium ions, store calcium. What do you think calcium is good for in your body? Bones, making bones strong. You are right, but that's not the most important function, and it's going to take all semester to talk about what the important functions are. And by the end of the semester, you'll see that you'll be willing to give your bones away to make these other things happen inside your body, right? And where that calcium is stored, right, is inside smooth endoplasmic reticulum, okay, calcium. And you might be worried because you don't want to give your bones away, do you? Why is that not so important? Okay, you'll see why. And you'll see why some people run out of bone strength as they get older. What's that condition called? It's a pathological condition when you lose bone strength because calcium is not in there. It's called osteoporosis, right? And we're all kind of susceptible to that unless we do something to our bones in the meantime. All right, so that's smooth endoplasmic reticulum. One last thing about this rough ER. These little dots right here are called ribosomes. And the function of a ribosome is to make a protein. And since it's associated with the endoplasmic reticulum, that confers that ability, that function to this kind of endoplasmic reticulum. So rough endoplasmic reticulum can make proteins because it has these ribosomes associated with it. You can have ribosomes floating around inside the cell. I can see some of these little dots floating around in the cytosol, not bound to the endoplasmic reticulum, but these free ribosomes still are responsible for protein synthesis, right? The only difference is free ribosomes make proteins that end up in the cytosol. Ribosomes that are associated with endoplasmic reticulum make proteins that end up inside the endoplasmic reticulum. They're not free to float around inside the cell. They're trapped inside this membrane. We'll see why that's important in just a little bit. All right, so ribosome is on your list a little bit later on down in this list, but now you know why it's there. It makes a protein. Golgi apparatus. Ah, okay, the rough endoplasmic reticulum you see kind of forms around the nucleus. This Golgi body kind of goes concave to that. It doesn't just follow the same contour of the nucleus. So that's how your eye can pick up a Golgi apparatus. The Golgi apparatus receives proteins that are made by the rough endoplasmic reticulum, right? And then it will change them, right? So the rough ER makes a protein, but maybe you need a sugar molecule bound to it. What do we call a protein with a sugar on it? That would be that glycoprotein, right? So the job of this Golgi right here is to conjugate different molecules together, bring different molecules together. So one thing, modification, right? The bullet point for Golgi, modification. And the second thing is that it then packages that modified material into a vesicle. So here's a vesicle. It's a membrane-bound organelle that contains things. All right, so the Golgi apparatus does two things. It modifies and it packages materials, right? Put stuff into a vesicle. And since that material is in a vesicle, again, it can't get inside the cell. It has to stay inside that vesicle. That's one of the possible fates. All right, we talked about the nucleus already. Right, it contains genetic material, contains DNA, DNA makes chromatin. Chromatin makes chromosomes. That is hereditary material that is transferred from one generation to the next, and that's a blueprint on how to make your body, which then means how your body functions or the cells function. All right, so here's that vesicle filled with stuff. And it can move over to the cell membrane. Remember that all membranes are very similar. So when it touches this membrane, they will join together. Have you ever had, did you ever make little soap bubbles with a hoop with a little bottle of soap last night over the weekend or something like that? Okay. A lot of times you get a couple bubbles floating around, they touch each other and they burst. But every once in a while, when those bubbles touch each other, what happens? They just form a big bubble, right? Because that soapy film is the same on both bubbles. Same thing here. So this vesicle fuses with the cell membrane, and whatever inside the vesicle then has access to the outside world. We call that secretion. So here would be an example of a secretory vesicle, because it's taking some kind of product that's made inside the cell and releasing it outside the cell. That's what we call secretion. This pathway of making a protein on rough ER, which then goes into the Golgi, which goes into a secretory vesicle, which then ends up outside the cell, we call that a secretory pathway. Secretory pathway requires a number of organelles for it to happen. Okay, so a protein that's made inside the cell has two possible fates. It can end up outside the cell if it's made by ribosomes on the rough endoplasmic reticulum, but it cannot end up outside the cell if it's made by a free ribosome. If it's made by a free ribosome, then that protein is inside the cell forever doing whatever job it's supposed to do. So that's pretty cool about this rough ER. Determines where this thing goes. There's another kind of vesicle inside a cell. We call that a lysosome. It's probably labeled, oh, here it is over here. It looks a lot like the secretory vesicle. This is an exam figure, but I don't think there's any way to tell the difference between a lysosome and the secretory vesicle over here. They're both spherical. They're both membrane-bound. But I do want you to know lysosomes are inside the cell. They contain something called the lysozyme. Lysozyme. And that sounds a lot like enzyme. And it is an enzyme. And the job of a lysosome is that it can break down materials that are inside. So lysosome is an enzyme that breaks things down into its tiny pieces. It's like a digestive enzyme. So a lysosome is really a digestive organ that is inside the cell. So I call it an intracellular digestion system. Intracellular digestive system. So if this mitochondria got surrounded by this lysosome, guess what would happen to this mitochondria? It would get broken down, right? Okay. And if a virus gets into this lysosome, what happens to it? It gets broken down. If a bacteria gets in, it gets broken down and killed. All right. But if the cell wants to break something down to recycle its components, it puts it in a lysosome, and then those components can be reused by the cell to make other kinds of things. So just remember, this is the breakdown system, digestive system inside the cell. That might be a little worrisome, because what happens if this membrane of a lysosome gets damaged and it releases lysozyme to the inside of the cell? So now you have that digestive enzyme running around everywhere inside the cell doing what? Digesting the cell away, right? And that happens to people, for instance, when they have a heart attack. Oxygen's not getting to their heart. These lysosomes in their heart start to release lysozyme, and then their own heart starts to dissolve their heart away. Right? But now we know that, so now we give certain drugs to protect the integrity of these membranes so that a person doesn't have to deal with that so much. Do you know what kind of medication protects membranes, kind of stabilizes, prevents inflammation? That would be steroids, cortisone, and things like that. So when somebody's having a heart attack, they're given these anti-inflammatories, and you might be wondering, why on earth are we doing that for somebody? Well, it's because of these lysosomes that are in there. Okay, mitochondria. Mitochondria. That's these guys right here. So what I want you to know is the name of these organelles by their shape, but also by their shape, not just their name, but I want you to know their function. So this is an exam figure. Make sure you know this is a mitochondria, this is smooth ER, and some function associated with them. I think you have a lot of good questions in your textbook. All right, so what's the function of this mitochondria? All right. It can take food molecules like glucose, maybe some fatty acids, and it can break those compounds down, and when it does, it gets energy from it. The mitochondria uses that energy to make ATP. All right, so some people think of this as the powerhouse of the cell because it makes ATP. The cell cannot live without ATP. All right, but in order for this mitochondria to make ATP from glucose, it needs another important compound. And it's the whole reason why we inhale. What are we bringing into our body? Oxygen, that's right. We inhale specifically to make these mitochondria happy. They've got to be happy, otherwise they're not going to make ATP. All right, so you need glucose, you need oxygen in order to make ATP. And in the process of making ATP with glucose and oxygen, it produces a byproduct that's toxic for us, which is the reason why we exhale. Carbon dioxide, that's right. So these mitochondria require glucose and oxygen, makes ATP and carbon dioxide, and then we got to get rid of that carbon dioxide by our respiration. All right, so this is a small little organelle, and so here's a membrane on the outside, and there's fluid on the inside. Okay, what does that sort of sound like when you got a membrane with cytoplasm inside of it? It sort of sounds like almost like a cell. Now here's something else that's really strange. Not only does it have cytoplasm and a membrane, it's got genetic material. It's got a chromosome. So what does that mean? If it's got cytoplasm, cell membrane, and genetic material, it's a cell all by itself. And when we look at it, it looks exactly like a bacterium, a certain kind of bacteria, like a bacillus. And indeed, it really is at one time a bacteria, but not just yesterday, but millions and millions of years ago. There were cells that had a nucleus and organelles, but not mitochondria. They weren't very efficient because they couldn't make a lot of ATP at any particular time. They got infected by a bacteria whose job is to make ATP as a byproduct of whatever they do, infected the cell, and the cell said, oh, well, we love that ATP. Maybe we're not going to kill this particular bacteria. Right? And this bacteria was fine because now it's protected from predation. Nothing else would eat it from the outside world. And it's the whole job of the rest of the structures in your body to deliver oxygen directly to it. So now this particular bacteria was happy because it got oxygen, it got glucose, and it was protected from everything else. So this is what we call a symbiosis, where two organisms come together, and in this particular case, one right inside the other, and we call that a symbiosis. They both provide benefit to each other. And they evolve together to now, these cells cannot live by themselves anymore. If we were to take all the mitochondria out of your body, your cells would die. If we take this mitochondria out of the cells, it would die. They have now formed a new kind of life form that we call a eukaryotic cell. And we call that the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria formation. Endosymbiont. Endosymbiont is actually what? An organism living inside of another organism together to support life. So that's maybe really strange for you guys to think about, that you have all these other organisms living inside you, right? Very complex situation. Okay, so that's something interesting about mitochondria because it's got all the components of a cell, and it looks like a bacteria too. Centrioles. Here's a centriole. Maybe you can see that it looks like a barrel, and then next to it, perpendicular to it, there's another barrel, and it's made up of microtubules. There is one here. The job of the centriole is to arrange these other filaments inside the cell. And these other filaments, sometimes they're called microfilaments, sometimes they're called microtubules, depending on how thick they are. And these microfilaments, they have a couple functions. You can see them pushing out to the cell membrane, so they help determine the shape of the cell. Some cells are flat, some are cuboidal, some are columnar, they're really long. So it's the job of these centrioles and microtubules to give the cell its particular shape. Right? But also, these microtubules form a railway system inside the cell. Right? And this railway system, so something can hop onto a microtubule here and get transported to another area within the cell. Because you saw this vesicle moving, right, from the Golgi apparatus all the way over to the cell membrane. The way that it gets there is by hopping a ride on a microtubule, and it gets delivered right there. So that's why I think of it as a railway system, but it's kind of special. It doesn't have two rails, it only has one. What kind of train are you familiar with that only has one rail? And you could just go a couple blocks and see one like that. It's called a monorail, and you could see a monorail at Disneyland, which is, I don't know how far away Disneyland is. Maybe it's a couple miles, right? So there is one of these special trains at Disneyland that just has one rail, but all of your cells have pretty much the same kind of thing all over the place. So you could think of, when you think of a microtubule, you could think of cell shape, or you could think of moving things around inside the cell. Arrangement of material inside the cell. And the centrioles then help determine what the function, where those microtubules are placed. Cilia and flagella, not on this slide. Your textbook used to have a picture. I don't have one handy to show you. But a cilium and a flagellum are projections that come off the surface of the cell. They're long projections. They're made up of microtubules, and these things can move. Just like things can move on a microtubule, these microtubules can move by themselves. And so cilia have a sweeping motion on the surface of a cell. A flagellum has a whipping motion. And so the function of cilia and flagella right here is motility. That's a really nice term, motility, which means what? Movement around, motility. Cilia have the ability to move things over the surface of the cell. And a flagellum allows a cell actually to swim around in a watery environment. So it's a little bit different, but both are motility. There's only one cell that has a flagellum in the human body, and it's only males. Ha, 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 and that is a sperm cell. Okay, it can swim around. It's half of a human cell. All right, so is a sperm cell motile? Would you say, yeah? Okay, why is it motile? Because it has a flagellum. Yeah, it has a flagellum. Okay. Cilia are maybe about a tenth or maybe even smaller than a flagellum. They're really small and they sweep all the time. They're just sweeping material over the surface of the cell. Microvilli kind of look like cilia. They're smaller than cilia, right? But they don't move. So motility is not what their function is because they don't move, even though that they project off of the surface of the cell, right? They are there for absorption. So for microvilli, you want to say absorption is their function. When a cell has microvilli, it's easier for material to go from outside the cell to inside the cell. We'll have to look at that a little bit later on in the class. Okay, the nucleus. Here is that nucleus. All right, would you be able to recognize these structures by their shape? Pretty much for a test. Yeah, and then you'll be able to match it up with a function because you're going to learn function by looking at these shapes right here. All right, so maybe on the test, I'm going to have a lead line because this is an exam figure. Maybe I'll have a lead line going, I'm going to erase this word, and I'm going to put it over here to this organelle. And your first impression would be to say, to pick out of the list mitochondria. But what if the question says function? What are you going to say? ATP synthesis, yeah. So if you see a picture like this with a blank lead line and the question is function, don't put mitochondria. You have to put ATP production, okay? So make sure you can match that up. Okay, cell membrane, nuclear structures. That's way at the end of this chapter. I talk about this in lab quite a bit. So I'll just point it out to you quickly. Okay, here's the nucleus. You can see it has pores within the nuclear membrane that allows material to move in and out of the membrane. There are things inside the membrane, like this dark spot. That's what we call the nucleolus. Some people might say nucleolus. You could say either one, nucleolus. That is just the active part of the nucleus. It contains mostly DNA. That's the active part. The rest of this material right here is made up of chromosomes. And if those chromosomes are busy, we say that it's chromatin. So DNA makes chromatin. Chromatin, when it's all put together, makes a chromosome. So let's look at this picture right here. So here is some DNA. And you can see it kind of looks like a coil, right? And it's got a couple of different kinds of chemicals. So I don't think I go over that in this class, but it's just a spiral thing, right? So that's DNA. DNA, right? DNA is put together sometimes with these proteins, right? And in which case we want to call that chromatin. And you see it's a really long, thin molecule. This kind of chromatin that's really long and thin is what we call extended chromatin. And that's kind of fragile because it's a really thin molecule. When your body wants to protect it, it wraps it around these proteins. And then these proteins get wrapped around each other. And then these wraps are wrapped some more. And then these bigger wraps even make even bigger wraps. And then you got super wraps around that. So that takes this big, long molecule and shortens it up by all of these wrappings. Okay. And when it's all wrapped up, we call that condensed chromatin. So here I see the chromosome, this X-shaped structure. It's made up of condensed chromatin. But when that chromatin is pulled off the chromosome because the cell needs to use it, then we call that extended chromatin. So extended chromatin is useful, but it can be damaged. Condensed chromatin is protected, but it can't be used to help the cell anymore. We go over that in lab. All right, so that's some things about the nucleus. And next time, I'm going to start talking about movement across membranes. This is what makes them special. All right, and we're going to talk about some physical properties like active and passive transport. So that's some physical chemistry, not too much physical chemistry, but a little bit. All right, so I think we're done at 12:05, right? Is that our end time in here? Yeah, so we're really close to being done. I got still some more stuff in this chapter. So sign the sign-in sheet, please. And will I see you Monday? Oh, rats, we're just getting started. But don't come, because Monday is a holiday. Yeah, so I'll see you 1 week from today. Yeah. Anything that's inclusive in that list is test material. Let me turn my recorder off so I don't record everything we're saying.